والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا محمد وعلى آله وأصحابه وأمته وبارك وسلم. وقد قال الله سبحانه وتعالى: أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. قد بدت البغضاء من أفواههم وما تخفي صدورهم أكبر لو كنتم تعلمون. Allah declares in the Holy Quran that indeed vehemence and antipathy has spewed forth from their mouths, hatred for Muslims and Islam. وَمَا تُخْفِي صُدُورُهُمْ أَكْبَرُ But what their hearts conceal is even worse. In this ayah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala refers to the sentiment and the attitude of the enemies of faith, of the enemies of truth, the enemies of Islam. And we cannot find it more appropriately manifest than in mainstream media, corporate media. Today I've decided to touch on the issue of the tragic event in Sydney. It happened a few weeks ago and I deliberately avoided it simply to wait for the filth to rise. Now what happened with Sydney and that hostage crisis, it was not a terrorist attack, it was not a siege, it was a hostage crisis. It resulted unfortunately in the death of three people. But all the important questions are not asked. Why on earth was this man, Harun Monis, man Harun Monis, who faced more than 40 sexual assault and indecency charges, who had been charged with being an accessory to the murder of his own wife, or ex-wife, still at liberty? Why did the Australian authorities refuse to send him back to Iran, his home country, who repeatedly requested his extradition via Interpol on other related charges, on charges also related to fraud in Iran? Why wasn't a man who had sent hate mail to Australian officials and who had publicly pledged his allegiance to the Islamic State, so-called ISIS, not being monitored by Australian security services? Now, these are basic questions that even Australians ask, and they need to be answered, but you notice they haven't really been answered in any intelligible, satisfactory way. Now we can agree that this man was an evil man. He should not have been at liberty. If we go by the conventional mainstream media narrative, now for a moment I'm just assuming that everything we saw on television was correct. That's the assumption we're making. But even if you take that as the basic point of reference, things begin to fall apart in the conventional narrative. So this volatile, disturbed character should not have been at liberty. We know that. But the question also that's not asked is about to what degree did Australian foreign policy, and particularly Australia's unconditional support for the United States and its military misadventures in the Middle East, to what extent did that radicalize people like this particular individual? And I hate this word radicalization. It's a word that we've just swallowed hook, line and sinker by the mainstream media. Why was he discontented? Why was he angry? Why was he protesting to that degree? Now obviously, as Muslims, like any other person, we disgust it. And we unequivocally condemn, no doubt, any act of violence against any innocent, whether that is perpetrated by a so-called radical terrorist or by the state apparatus of the United States or Australia in foreign countries. We condemn it all. We don't judge by the color of skin. But we need to have an honest, grown-out debate with our Australian friends and also amongst ourselves. As far as Muslims are concerned, the interventionist policy of Australia in recent years must at least be regarded as culpable, as responsible in creating this so-called radicalization within certain elements of the Muslim public. And I hate using that word, but the reaction, the protest, the abhorrence, the anger of the Muslim world is justified because of open, egregious wars against Muslim civilian populations, not even Muslim governments or dictators. So, with Australia having this unconditional blank check support for the United States military campaigns, this no doubt is a cause of most of the problems we find, even in Australia. And until it doesn't address that, it will not help to counter so-called global instability, if it's really serious about it. But Australia, like the United States, like England, like NATO, thrive on instability and fabricated crises to justify their theft, essentially. It's theft of world resources. and it's a need to extend and to consolidate Anglo-American hegemony of the world. That's basically what it is all about. So let's really think over the last decade or so about how the US actions backed by Australia have led to or have bolstered this cause of so-called radicalism. And this is if we take the mainstream narrative. So even if we take the mainstream narrative, really, the Australian government has a lot to answer for. Now, in 2001, in the aftermath of 9/11, Australian Prime Minister John Howard, who incidentally has been indicted for war crimes, pledged to George W. Bush, who also has been indicted for war crimes, but will never really face the gauntlet, simply because in this world, well, power and wealth rule and dictate outcomes, not justice. But in any case, our John Howard pledged his country's fullest support to the United States' so-called war on terror, in spite of the fact that the greatest terror is the state terror of the United States and its allies. Now, that meant that Australian troops taking part in the invasion and the occupation of Afghanistan as being part of the coalition of the willing literally opened the Pandora's box. And also that extended to Iraq. And in the US, we find that the government, its allies as well, should have learned from history, including recent history. But firstly, when it comes to Afghanistan, foreign invasions of Afghanistan routinely end in failure. The English tried it. Alexander the Great before that tried it many thousands of years ago. Every subsequent empire has tried that. The Russians tried it. But of course, given the arrogance of the Western mindset and the so-called interventionist liberal elite, they didn't take heed to that. In fact, if anything, this was part of playing out Brzezinski's arc of crisis theory. That if we can maintain an arc of crisis across Central Asia, we will break the possibility and the capacity of Asian nations or Eurasian nations establishing what they call the Eurasian land bridge. Essentially, countries like China, Russia, India, Persia, Iran, and other countries forming an independent economic bloc. So we need to keep that area in a state of continuous crisis. So what happened after more than 14 or 15 years, in spite of the likes of our very dim-witted prime ministers? The Taliban were not defeated. I mean, our prime ministers like Gillard said that we will be there for another 100 years. And within a year, Australian troops had to withdraw with their tails between their legs. The Taliban were not defeated, although it's not a war against the Taliban. It's a war against Pashtun tribesmen, people who simply don't want others to be occupying their land. So outside the confines of large cities like Kabul or Peshawar, the Taliban still rule. Osama bin Laden wasn't really put out of action, or at least not until 2011. And 14 years after the invasion, Afghanistan is more radicalized. The costly occupation of Afghanistan led to greater Muslim resentment across the world against the West, and a new generation determined to fight against the occupiers of Muslim lands. So they've actually created fertile grounds or the fertile pastures in which so-called radicalization could be fostered. If you look at Iraq, the consequences of the Iraq invasion have been even worse. Now, mainstream Australian media will never talk about this, although this is the fundamental fact. If you want to discover the so-called siege in Sydney, you have to start off with Australia's culpability in creating those monsters. So if you look at Iraq, the US and its allies forcibly toppled a functional, albeit a secular government, but a functional government, which was a strong regional bulwark against the West's assumed Al-Qaeda and fundamentalist enemies in general. Saddam Hussein was a secularist, he was a Marxist, he was a Ba'athist. But what he did have was a functional government. I'm not in any way suggesting that Saddam Hussein was a hero of Islam and Muslims, no way. In fact, he was no more than an agent and a lackey of the United States. We know that. He came to power as a direct consequence of America's interventionist policies in the Middle East, particularly toppling a democratically elected government and them challenging America's control over the petroleum industry. So we're not going to go into that history, but eventually what Saddam Hussein did do was create a functional state. And what did we find? John Howard again strikes a triumphant tone. He says, not only was the military operation completed quickly when we invaded Iraq and successfully, but it was also worth recording that all the doomsday predictions were not realized. And this he said in 2003. He also said that the Iraq invasion had brought about a permanent change of attitudes in the Middle East. Yeah, it did. A permanent change of even increased resentment against Western nations in the Middle East. So the invasion of Iraq, the toppling of Saddam Hussein, and remember he was this aging, cigar-smoking, Sound of Music-loving secularist. He was a secularist. And if you look at his long-standing foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, he was a practicing Christian. So, essentially, the policies of the Howard government and the United States, incidentally, Australia has no foreign policy. It's got no independent foreign policy. Its foreign policy is dictated to by the United States. Gough Whitlam passed away not too long ago. And the media did everything in its power to suppress one of the greatest achievements of Whitlam, and that was standing up to American dictatorial attitudes towards Australia. But nothing was said of that. The last independent, truly democratically elected Australian Prime Minister was Gough Whitlam. Read the history. Subsequent to that, Australia has had no foreign, independent foreign policy. It's dictated to by Washington or by the American embassy in Canberra. So, what we find that the policies of the Howard government plays right into the hands of the so-called Al-Qaeda and other supposed anti-Western fundamentalist groups. They create again the fertile ground in which this extremism or the so-called radicalism, which they are so abhorred by, flourishes. Now, there were many opponents of the war, even in Australia, non-Muslim. And they warned that following the toppling of the Saddam Hussein government and the Ba'athist regime, they warned that Iraq would fall into chaos and it would become a magnet for all sorts of radical ideals and radical thoughts. The anti-war movement also argued throughout that an attack on Iraq by inflaming Arab and Muslim opinion would lead only to more instability. There would be more terrorist activity in the Middle East. And all the evidence to date shows that the war has had such a radicalizing effect. But this was known to the Howard government before. It was known to the then Bush government. It was, in all fairness, intended to create that scenario of instability and of radicalization. So when they go on screaming in the media and pulling their hair out in protest and abhorrence at what was done to innocent Sydneysiders, that is part of showmanship to deflect and detract from their culpability and their responsibility in creating those monsters. Deflect attention away from their culpability and directing it towards a brown-skinned foreigner. And unwittingly, again, the Australian public falls straight into the trap. They become the Gurkhas again, the cannon fodder for imperial power. And once again, we find our Abbott government towing line and sending more troops to be slaughtered in a mindless war. At least that's what the media would like you have you believe. It's actually not mindless, it's calculated. So at every step of the way, we find the United States and its allies, like Australia, are indirectly or directly boosting the cause of so-called extremism or radicalization. In fact, they're the prime sponsors also of terrorism, as we find revealed in WikiLeaks and by Snowden, a clear link between American sponsorship, both military and financial, through Qatar and Saudi Arabia of these radical groups. Direct sponsorship. So while we find that the so-called moderate Ba'athist Tariq Aziz remain incarcerated in prison in Iraq, the current Amir, so-called Khalif of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, was released at the very same time by the Americans from Iraqi jail. How do you explain that? Obviously, Abbott will never comment on that. Neither will Australian media ever talk about it. But even after Iraq, we find US foreign policy carried on along the same so-called neocon-inspired path, targeting secular, socialist, stable governments and aiding so-called radicals. So if you look at Muammar Gaddafi, if you look at his Libya, it was also a bulwark against so-called Islamic extremism. And it was earmarked for regime change in 2011. So Libya became the new Iraq, and a country which actually had the highest standards of living in Africa was transformed into a failed state. a fertile ground for so-called radicalization. And incidentally, we find that the radicals from Libya find their way to Syria, and also armaments are used to prosecute a war against the civilian population of Syria and Iraq through ISIS, facilitated primarily by the United States and its allies like our wonderful government, the Australian government. Let's take a look at Syria. Now remember, we're talking about all of this in the context of what happened in Sydney. The Australian government has to step up to the plate and assume responsibility for its failed foreign policies. And until it hasn't done that, it would be ridiculous or absurd to even ask the Muslim community to comment on a monster that really we have not created. And we'll talk about that. This obscene cycle of apologetics on the part of the media and the government institutions expecting Muslims to apologize and to condemn acts of terror in their name. It's absurd. It's ridiculous. But we'll talk about that in a little while. Let's take Syria. If you look at Syria, the Syrian authorities foiled many Al-Qaeda plots in Syria. When it came to so-called Al-Qaeda plots to bomb the U.S. embassy in Damascus in 2006, it was the Assad regime that was instrumental in exposing and prosecuting the perpetrators of that would-be terror plot. In any genuine war on so-called Al-Qaeda or Islamic extremism, Ba'ath al-Syria, which is a secular government, the country where Christians and other religious minorities enjoyed freedom of worship, and no way am I suggesting that they were champions of the Islamic cause, but the fact of the matter is, it was again a functional government in which religious minorities and religious communities had the freedom to worship in spite of the heavy-handedness of the government. And in no way am I suggesting that they're champions of Islam. But from a secular perspective, they are natural allies. And also, if you look at the Yazidis and the Christians, they had not just full freedom, but enjoyed prominence even in the Syrian secular government. They would have been regarded as a natural ally. But no, the United States targets another functional, stable Arab government for violent regime change. And what is really, you know, a euphemism, the so-called color revolutions, were a fifth column attempt at subversion and what eventually became the complete decimation of another functional Arab state. So what happens? So-called anti-government rebels are portrayed as cuddly, peace-loving Democrats through that so-called Arab Spring in Syria. And the Western media begin to trumpet their cause, and the extremist associations are played down and ignored altogether. While many were warning that those so-called revolutionaries against the Assad government are actually Al-Qaeda or those type of radical extremist groups seeking another foothold. And that's taking the conventional narrative. But let's not forget that just 16, 18 months ago, the same Western leaders, including our own Abbott, was warning us about the threat from ISIS. They were baying for airstrikes against the Syrian government, which was then fighting ISIS and other extremists. And like the United States and the UK, we find even Kevin Rudd prior to Abbott took a hawkish line against Assad, calling for robust international response. But at a time when the Assad government was assisting the United States and Western governments in suppressing so-called Al-Qaeda-inspired radicalism, Tony Abbott then comes to power. And what's interesting, when Tony Abbott was in opposition, there's a very interesting quote I have here. He actually takes issue with Rudd at that time. He seems to reflect more political wisdom as an opposition figure than as a prime minister. So Abbott says to Rudd that this idea that Australia is going to be a key player in Syria, I think, to rather exaggerate our own importance, should not occur. And if any action be taken place, it will be taken by countries with the capacity to do so, and Australia is not one of those. We can't get involved. Now, Abbott's stance in 2013 on Syria, while in opposition, was quite sensible. It's hard to say the same about his decisions now in government. It's been back to interventionism. Abbott then signs Australia up to the military campaign against the Islamic State. And Australian planes have been bombing ISIS positions in Iraq, so-called, but effectively further incapacitating the Assad government. What is being targeted here is the Assad government. ISIS is just a pretext. It's a conventional excuse to further the interventionist agenda of primarily the United States and NATO powers. Now, many people warned Abbott against getting Australia involved in another lengthy military campaign, particularly given that Australia's fiscal and economic health is not much to be desired. We are in an economic crisis. Money is being taken away from pensioners. Old people have to choose whether to go to the toilet or to eat. Children are being deprived of adequate educational facilities. Universities are being stripped of their funding. Public infrastructure has been put on the back shelf. Why? To prosecute a war that really the Australian public don't want and that many in the Australian establishment have been vehemently against. So we find comments like those from Tom Switzer saying that Washington and its allies such as Australia need to think clearly and perhaps coldly about any further military intervention. Australia should not follow the US into this mess. And this is what many Australian intellectuals and academics and even senior political figures have been saying. But they've been ignored. The Australian public are opposed to any interventionist war. If you take another article in the Quadrant entitled The Case Against the New Iraq War, what Switzer says is that the current disaster in Iraq and the rise to dominance of ISIS was the war against Saddam's regime. To repeat, he says, it was the US invasion that shattered the secular state which allowed age-old ethnic and sectarian tensions to resurface. The result has been Iraq's descent into anarchy and violence. All of this we know. If one remains unconvinced about the link between the invasion and the mayhem and extremism today, think about it this way. Before March 2003, there was no fundamentalist terrorism problem in Iraq. Since so-called liberation by the West, Iraq has attracted extremists like flies to a dying animal. So instead of blindly following the policies of Washington, Australian leaders would have been better off listening to the views of the realists within government and academics who have been challenging their policies. If you look at John Pilger as well, who's been sharply critical of his country's foreign policy, we find voices of sanity echoing the same truth that we all embrace. And that is, don't interfere in other people's domestic issues. Don't invade other people's lands. Don't steal their resources. It's as simple as that. But Australia, like the United States, insists on stealing. It insists on interfering in other people's domestic affairs. And it insists on using violence as the only political or the only diplomatic option open. Now, Australia didn't have to get involved in the wars prosecuted by the United States in the Middle East. These wars have only boosted so-called radical terrorists, and I hate using these words. It's made people angry. And it's consequently increased the dangers faced by Australian citizens if we go by the conventional narrative. But I think what may be closer to the truth, and this is what I'll discuss next week, is that this extremism and, as a consequence, the crises that emerge at regular intervals are actually by design. What we need to remember is that the Islamic world and Muslims are really not the target. Again, that's part of the media narrative. Muslims are the victims and the perpetrators are Western powers. Muslims have lost everything. The Muslim world was colonized more than 200 years ago. The Ottoman Khilafah, the last bastion of an Islamic public order, came to an end in 1924. The bulk of the Muslim world has been living under colonial repression for the better part of a century and a half, if not more. If you take parts of the world like Java and Sumatra for the better part of 300 years, Muslims have lost their lands, they've lost their wealth, they represent the impoverished third world, when at a time the Islamic world was the dominant civilization and the wealthiest of the nations of the world. Muslims have been raped, their children have been orphaned, their lands have been pillaged, they have been living as subjugated people, they have been humiliated, they enjoy no honor and no prestige in the world as a consequence of a brutal colonial campaign over the better part of 200 years. They really have nothing more to lose. What you call Muslim governments or Islamic states are actually just Western states governed by proxies on behalf of erstwhile colonial powers. Saudi Arabia being the best example of a colonial surrogate state, ruled by the Saudi dynasty on behalf of first the United Kingdom, or Great Britain, and now the United States. And that applies to every other so-called Muslim country. The true target of these wars on terror is actually Western nations, Western people. It is their liberties that are being jettisoned in the name of a war on terror. It is their laws that have been abrogated, laws and freedoms that they fought for over hundreds of years to secure. First against tyrannical churches, the Catholic Church being the biggest culprit, and thereafter despotic regimes and feudal systems and kingdoms. Essentially, their freedoms, their civil liberties, their rights, their law is the target of these wars on terror. Muslims really have nothing more to lose. We can possibly not lose anything else. But they have everything to lose. And until and unless they don't realize that this bogus war on terror is a war against Western liberties, Western society, Western freedoms, the wealth of Western nations, the autonomy of Western sovereign states, this circus will continue. So first and foremost, what we need to emphasize is that the hype and hysteria associated by the events in Sydney, if even we go by the conventional narrative as portrayed in the media, leaves us with a single conclusion, and that is that the Australian government, insofar as its foreign policies are concerned, are directly responsible and culpable for this mayhem and so-called carnage in Sydney. We don't even know really what happened. We don't even know who the trigger man really was, who the puppeteers really were, who really orchestrated what seems to be quite an absurd event. But given conventional wisdom, still blame can be laid squarely at the feet of the Australian government and its foreign policies. We'll go through the issue of Muslims being harassed by the media and by the political establishment to condemn every act of violence perpetrated against Western people or Western nations in their name. And there's this ritual that each and every one of the world's 1.5 to 2 billion Muslims, especially those living in the Western countries, is expected to go through immediately following any incident of violence involving a Muslim perpetrator. This ritual, it's continuing. It's happened with Sydney, in which this deranged man, Haron Monis, takes people hostage and supposedly kills one of them. Muslim organizations and Muslim individuals are expected to say that as a Muslim, I do not condone this attack. I do not condone this terrorism in any form. Islam has nothing to do with terrorism. Now, this expectation that is placed on Muslims is Islamophobic. This expectation that Muslims have to always apologize for what a supposed Muslim perpetrator does is actually racist. It's bigoted. The denunciation is actually a form of apology. It's an apology for Islam and for Muslims. That's essentially what it is. You have to apologize for Islam and Muslims. And the implication is that every Muslim is under suspicion, and that every Muslim is being sympathetic to terrorism unless he or she explicitly says otherwise. So the default position is that Muslims are guilty unless and until proven innocent. And the innocence will be asserted by the degree to which they can condemn or distance themselves from this assumption of guilt. It's racist. Coming from South Africa, this is the most offensive thing I've ever had a government or media establishment ask me to do. Because we know racism better than most people. And we're sick and tired of this racism. We're sick and tired of this notion that the Western Roman comes to civilize the barbarian, and that we need to be civilized and taught how to behave in public. The implication is also that any crime committed by a Muslim is the responsibility of all Muslims simply by virtue of their shared religion. This is another implication. So as soon as we start to apologize, this is the assumption that we affirm. Now, this sort of thinking, blaming an entire global population of almost 2 billion for the actions of a few individuals, assuming the worst about a person just because of their identity, is the very definition of racism.
Australia
foreign policy is racist at its core. And as a South African, I can safely tell you that because I've lived through it. The only difference is that we are more resilient and we know how to deal with the monster. But many like you are first generation immigrants to this country, have some difficulty. Don't apologize. There's no need to. I've been also harangued into apologizing. And frankly, I'm sick and tired of it. I will not do it in future. Don't do it. Inshallah, next week we'll continue with this. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.